'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, but Kristen was podcasting. And Kristen came to the realization that she hadn't given you amazing podcast listeners any presents for Christmas. Now, there's still going to be a Ticklish Business Christmas episode. Samantha and I are recording it. It's going to be on Holiday Affair, and it's going to be amazing. But in the meantime, and because we'll be going on hiatus until January, I wanted to give you guys a little something special. Now, if you've heard, I've probably talked a lot on the podcast. Actually, I know I've talked a lot on the podcast about my Patreon and the supplemental shows that I've been doing. Well, I started them earlier this year and they've been a lot of fun to do, but you guys who aren't patrons haven't actually gotten to listen to them yet. So I wanted to give back by letting you guys listen to them, courtesy of Ticklish Business. So the next couple of episodes are going to be Patreon exclusive stuff that is now available for you guys to listen to. And we're going to start things off with the show I do with William Bibbiani called Based on a True Podcast. Now, I was going to show you our first episode, which we did on RKO 281, but I didn't actually have theme music for it yet. And I wanted to give you guys the best episode that I could, so I'm going to give you our next episode, which is on the 2006 Ben Affleck film Hollywoodland about the George Reeves murder. So I hope you guys enjoy it. I'm going to be giving out some more Patreon content in between the Christmas episode, and I'll be back in January with all new stuff. So have a great holiday. And thank you for listening to Based on a True Podcast, a Ticklish Business subsidiary, the show devoted to cinematic depictions of Hollywood's true stories, blending fact and fiction with a dose of salaciousness. I'm your host, Kristen Lopez, here with my partner in crime, William Bibbiani. Bibbs, how are you?
I am fine. I am engaged in acts of extreme criminality. Earlier, I loitered.
The loitering, I'm assuming, was beneficial.
It worked out great for me.
If you don't know the podcast already, hopefully you went back and listened to our pilot episode, which we discussed RKO 281, talked about Orson Welles. This episode, we're going to get into some crime, because I figured what better way to do a biopic show than also include elements of the true crime podcast boom, which everybody seems to love. So I am both of the curve and... I don't know, are we one of many, or are we just trying to get in with the zeitgeist? Are we down with the kids?
I don't know. True crime stories, especially in Hollywood, have always been in fashion, whether you go back to the scandal rags of the original golden age of Hollywood.
Confidential, yeah.
Or even when I was a kid, when E! Premiered as a network on cable, one of their first big hit shows was basically true Hollywood crime.
Ugh, I miss those days. I miss the days, too, when the National Enquirer, it never had clout, but it at least was good if you wanted some true crime, questioning, murder mystery type of stuff. I don't even know what's in the Enquirer anymore.
I've looked. It's pretty bad. I wouldn't encourage it. And it's all the same crimes over and over again. Like, it's, oh, we looked at this crime that happened 30 years ago. No new crimes have been committed? Come on.
Yeah, we're still talking about Natalie Wood today, you know?
I know.
I literally just saw Dr. Phil, his new season, is promoting the Natalie Wood murder mystery. And I'm like, you know, there's other mysteries out there. I love Natalie. Mayday will actually do the Natalie Wood story, which is a biopic that exists. There are other mysteries out there.
And we're about to talk about one of them, and one of the more notorious and more famous ones. And in fact, when you told me about this podcast you wanted to do, this was one of the movies you were very particular about wanting to get to. And I would like you to tell our listeners all about it, and I'd like to know why this one really speaks to you as something that was really important to us to get to quickly.
So we're talking about 2006's Hollywoodland. This is directed by Alan Coulter, who I believe most people know from Game of Thrones, correct?
He's done a lot of TV.
A lot of
That's
TV.
That's where he lived. He did Boardwalk Empire. Actually, I don't think he did Game of Thrones.
Oh, he did. Okay, so Boardwalk Empire, I think, is what I was looking at. I knew there was an HBO thing in there. He did
The Sopranos. He did 6 Feet Under, Sex and the City. He worked on a lot of television, and this is his only major movie.
This is his first film out of, right now I'm perusing, out of two films. He did this, and then he followed it up in 2010 with the Robert Pattinson 9/11 film, Remember Me.
Well, that was a twist in Remember Me. So you just spoiled Remember Me for
of
our listeners.
Yeah. I think after 8 years, it's pretty good.
If you haven't seen Remember Me by now, that's on you.
Most people didn't see it 8 years ago. So I did. Yeah. I did. And I think I'm the only person that says Remember Me is actually a good movie. But that is for a different time. I've always been fascinated by the George Reeves story, mostly because my grandfather was a big Superman fan. He loved Superman till his dying day, and he remembered watching the Superman television series as a kid and really looking up to George Reeves and what Superman espoused. So when this movie came out, actually came out the week of my birthday in 2006. I didn't even realize that until I looked at the release day. I'm like, oh, September 8th, my birthday, September 1st. I probably saw this the week of my birthday. And it's a movie that most people know that George Reeves died, that there were mysterious circumstances, but there had not been a movie that attempted to contextualize all of that. I do think it's a bit of a ripoff of LA Confidential in many ways. I think I connect this a lot to my grandfather and the fact that there was this mystery here. And George Reeves always is a classic example of the man who was typecast, that he was so representative of America. And a lot of what people find fascinating about his story is that he's almost struck down by fame. He's the guy, the sole embodiment of this enormous figure that the weight crushed him. It's a pure Hollywood story.
And when this movie came out, it was positioned as a big Oscar contender. Everyone thought Ben Affleck was going to get nominated for an Oscar. He did win a couple of awards here or there.
Really under the radar.
Yeah, and when you watch it, it's easy to see why. It's good, but it's never great. The performances are solid, but the movie that they decided to tell, they made some narrative choices that I think took the emphasis away from George Reeves and onto a fictional character for reasons which might make thematic sense, but it's not really why we came to see the film. We came to the film to see the George Reeves story. And granted, we don't really know how that ended, and the movie offers a couple of different alternate explanations as to what exactly happened to him. Was he murdered, some people believe? Was he murdered the way other people believe, or did he simply kill himself? Kudos to the film for not giving a pat stupid answer. At some point, we might do the movie version of Black Dahlia.
Oh, yeah.
Well, which they just solve the murder, and it's just really unsatisfying.
Will you talk about why this movie sailed under the radar? And I agree. I remember this movie was poised to be a big budget. A lot of the problem is, and I mentioned this a couple of seconds ago, this was poised to be LA Confidential with a truer story. And I think a lot of the issues that people have with this movie is comparing it to that film. Because there are a lot of commonalities based on Hollywood rumor and scandal. You have a detective in both stories with a tragic past. In fact, Bud White, the Russell Crowe character in LA Confidential, has a very similar story to Adrian Brody's Louis Simo regarding his dad. Very similar plot trajectories. It's LA Confidential with the George Reeves story in here, and it doesn't really know how to bridge the two. This also came out the same year as The Black Dahlia.
He has these similar elements. He wanted it to be like LA Confidential. On one hand, I would argue it's simply just not as well-crafted as LA Confidential, but it's also just not as stylish either. Alan Coulter is a fine director, but he doesn't bring a lot of zazz to this. Whereas Curtis Hanson, a filmmaker who worked in a variety of different genres, but always brought something special to each of his movies, and his love of the 1950s gelled with James Ellroy's love of the 1950s, gelled with Brian Helgeland's love of the 1950s. It's film noir, it's Hollywood, but it's trying to be the ultimate version of both of those things, and they had the craft to pull that off. Whereas a lot of this movie feels like they did not have, maybe not the budget because it's kind of an intimate story, but they didn't have the scope. It doesn't feel big. It actually feels really tiny. It never feels like Adrian Brody is seriously on the verge of cracking this case. He feels like a guy who lives in a motel, who has a couple of crackpot theories, and at the end, he never finds out. That's not very satisfying.
I'm going to use an actual example. This is like reading a Nathan Heller novel. If anybody's read Max Allen Collins' series of books about Nathan Heller, who is like Forrest Gump, he just stumbles onto famous cases, and then Max Allen Collins gives you his theories through this detective trying to solve them. I would love them to turn that series into a movie franchise, but this is about as close as we've gotten. Black Dahlia came out a week after.
Wow.
Literally 7 days after this movie. That did not help either. Both of them are very similar on the surface in terms of being about a famous case, trying to investigate and come up with some theories. The other one, though, is a De Palma film. And so, yeah. Depending on how you feel about De Palma, I personally hate Black Dahlia.
I think it's one of his worst movies.
It's a terrible movie. And this is decidedly better. You brought up that this movie doesn't have a lot of the style. And it does feel like we spent all the money on A-list stars. And then we realized we needed a director and a script. And then they just had to pay with what they had. That's no disrespect to Alan Coulter, who I actually think does a really good job. The script, though, credited to Paul Birnbaum, who I think desperately wants to be Frank Darabont with this movie. And previously, he was known as a TV screenwriter, TV movie director. He had done all three of the Halloween Town movies.
Or at least he did the characters and other people adapted them. But he did the Nightmare Room.
He did a teleplay for one episode of The New Mike Hammer in 1984, so that could explain some stuff.
He also did a show that I'm desperate to track down for my other podcast, Canceled Too Soon. It was a short-lived UPN series about video game characters who burst into the real world and are bad guys called Deadly Games.
Ooh, that sounds interesting.
Doesn't it? It's hard to find.
When you put that out there, you understand this movie is a bit too prestigious for what we have in terms of background.
And it's also a little tricky because we're doing a film that is about the guy who played Superman, and Superman is a really important part of that story. And it's not a Warner Brothers film.
I want to say there was controversy about whether they were going to be able to use the Superman logos because of the studio. And so you see him in the Superman suit at the beginning, and it's gray. They eventually are able to use it, but there is this fear, this hesitancy to focus too highly.
It was a different color, partly because they were filming it in black and white, right. And it didn't matter if it was in color. The bigger issue was the original title for the film was Truth, Justice, and the American Way.
Yes.
And Warner Brothers nixed to that. They said, no way. The other thing was they weren't allowed to use the Superman logo in marketing. So basically, they were allowed to use it in the film, but they weren't allowed to show the S shield in any of the marketing. So what you've got here is a movie about how Superman killed himself, and unless you already know he's Superman, you're not going to find out. It's really, really, really tricky. And yet, it makes you wonder, though, because if you look at a film like Saving Mr. Banks, which is also about a property that is owned by a corporation, that is a film that is about basically why Disney knew better about Mary Poppins than the creator of Mary Poppins. I think the fact that that movie was made by Disney means you were going to get that. I wonder if you would have gotten a movie that was this cynical, that was this dark about Hollywood and Superman. No one ever says a kind word about Superman in this entire movie. I wonder if you would have gotten that if it had been made by Warner Brothers. Probably not. So it's probably worth the trade.
This movie is a very dark take on Superman and the George Reeves story when it focuses on it. So in case people don't know, I mean, George Reeves started his career in 39. He was one of the Tarleton brothers in Gone with the Wind, which the movie references. The movie, when we talk about references, the movie,
Paul Birnbaum
really did his homework, because there are things in here that are very small bits of minutia that are really great to see. So he started in Gone with the Wind, dabbled in B-films and bit parts. Stuff like Strawberry Blonde. If you watch him in So Proudly We Hail, he is the war soldier that Claudette Colbert falls in love with. And as soon as you see him, and you only know George Reeves as Superman. He's got something. He's got that all-American pizzazz, but that's all he has. He's a healthy American man, but there's no, like, leading man matinee idol quality to him. The last thing he had done before he found Adventures of Superman, he'd been starring in The Adventures of Sir Galahad and one of the Jungle Jim movies. If anybody's seen any of those, it's like Tarzan after all of that had gone away. But in June of 51, he was offered the lead in Superman. He didn't want it, though, because he thought TV was beneath him and he assumed that it wasn't going to make any money. Started off as this B-movie with a 13-episode first season, and it was a hit. It was a huge, huge hit. But the problem was is that per the contract, you couldn't work on anything else while the series was in production. And while he was eventually making a lot of money, I think it was $5,000 an episode, which with inflation would be about $50,000 an episode today. But that was only when the series was in production. So he wasn't getting paid when the show wasn't being made, but yet he wasn't able to work on anything while it was in production. And so there was a lot of animosity there. He tried to leave it several times. He became representative of the role. There's a scene in the movie where he's in From Here to Eternity, and they're watching the test screening, and they're making fun of his performance. The rumor is that he was significantly cut because of the guffaws that he was getting for being Superman. There's controversy on whether that's true or if he was cut for time. There's rumors that he was so good they cut him because he was overshadowing the A-list stars.
I've heard the story that he actually wasn't in it any more than he already was.
There could be no real rumor to it. But it was something that he felt was both a blessing and a curse. The thing that I was interested in, there's a scene in the movie where he's smoking in a restaurant. And this is where I think we talk about the movie being very cynical. He's smoking in a restaurant, and he sees a bunch of children outside. Diane Lane, who plays Tony Mannix's girlfriend, says Superman doesn't smoke, and he has to put it out. It's others who tell him that he needs to represent Superman, but he actually did that himself. He wanted to be a good role model for children. And I think the movie has this really cynical, realistic portrayal of Reeves, which is that if you are being told all the time that you embody perfection, how does that make you feel? It has to make you feel like you're on the hook all the time. It does make you think when you find out that George Reeves was really into his persona and he wanted to be a good example. It does make you think, okay, so the concept is just to turn him into a dick. But it does present an authenticity to him.
Well, here's the deal. He was an actor and it was a job. He was told to be Superman, and not just on stage. He would appear in person as Superman. Did you see the Isle of Lucy episode where he guest starred?
Yeah.
So this great Isle of Lucy episode where little Ricky wants to go see Superman and he can't, but Ricky knows Superman. And very pointedly, they never call him George Reeves.
No.
That is Superman. He meets Superman. George Reeves is not George Reeves. George Reeves is Superman. And that's the kind of blur between reality and fantasy that we very rarely have nowadays with our performers. I think musicians get that a lot. Is she Lady Gaga or is she Madonna? That kind of persona. But we usually enter into that sort of willingly. George Reeves took a gig for the money, did the job, was told to be inspiring to kids, and was good at it. But it was just a job for him. And so there's this scene in the movie where he's about to do this live show, but backstage, he's just kicking back and joking with Teamsters.
He's smoking, talking about whether you can see his junk through his suit. It's really funny, because it does remind you that this guy was an actor. He had flaws. Well, obviously, he had a lot of personal flaws because of his relationships. And the funny thing is that the Superman appearance on Lucy was close to the end of the series run. And they wanted to do a big film, but there was issues with negotiations with the schedule. And by that point, George Reeves was done. Wanted to come out of the role. They were trying to replace him. He did try to leave several times, but he said, there's a quote, and I'm reading courtesy of Wiki, quote, "After the I Love Lucy show, Superman was no longer a challenge to him. He enjoyed the role, but he used to say, 'Here I am wasting my life.'" That's a very bleak outlook, and that's why I think the movie, it ends essentially with the third theory, which is that maybe he did just kill himself. That's where the movie, when it's actually deconstructing the pressure of having to live up to a character, it's a testament to Ben Affleck, who we can talk about in a second, I think is really good in this movie. But the sad fact at the end of the movie that he just says goodnight to these people, goes up to his bedroom, and then blows his brains out. So that could be the sad reality of this whole thing.
When you look at it, the whole point, the whole reason that George Reeves allegedly killed himself was that he had been conflated with this sort of Hollywood mystique, this character that he had created, and it's a double tragedy that in his death, people want to add more mystique. People want to add more pizzazz to it. We can't just let him die. We have to come up with conspiracy theories and maybe not fiance did it, or oh, maybe his girlfriend who was married to a studio head had him murdered out of jealousy. We look at George Reeves and we see things. Kids saw a superhero. The adults in this movie see, oh, just another Hollywood stew. Whatever veil you look through, that's what you see. With George Reeves. Again, I don't know all the details of the case, but a part of me is just like, people do kill themselves, and it's always tragic, and it's always sad, and they always have their reasons. Maybe you would call them terrible reasons, but they did it, and they thought that that was the thing to do at the time. So for me, I'm watching this movie, and I just feel bad for George Reeves, not just because he died under such unfortunate circumstances, but because he felt so trapped by an institution that even after his death, he could not escape. And that's the thing I think is really interesting about it, although I feel that the movie doesn't really address that level of obsession the way it probably should have. I feel like Adrian Brody should have gone way further down that rabbit hole in order to sell that point and justify the existence of his character.
George Reeves died of a single gunshot wound to the head in his Benedict Canyon home between 1:30 and 2 a.m. June 16th of 1959. That's what we know. The police arrived within the hour, but there was a delay between calling the cops, which is never good. In the house, it was George Reeves' fiance, possibly, Leonore Lemon, played in the movie by Robin Tunney, writer Robert Condon, another man named William Bliss, and Carol von Ronkel, who lived a few blocks away. And according to these people, Lemon and Reeves had been drinking along with Robert Condon. They had an argument at the restaurant in front of Robert Condon. They all came back home. Supposedly, Leonore Lemon said that she and Reeves were not there. There's, again, dispute about so many of these events, about who did what when.
And it's worth noting that in all of these situations, everyone freely admits that they were really drunk.
Yes, everybody was totally soused. At some point near midnight, George Reeves went to bed, where there was an impromptu party where William Bliss, Carol von Ronkel, came to the Reeves house. Reeves came downstairs, complained about the noise, proceeded to stay with them, hang out, and then went to bed really angry. And that's when they heard a single gunshot from upstairs. They went up, found him on the bed, dead, facing upward, nude, with his feet on the floor. Supposedly, the body fell back based on how he would have shot himself. There was a pistol between his feet. According to the witnesses, Leonore Lemon, the other guests, made apologies for their delay in calling the police because they were shocked. It was also very late and they were really drunk. And that's why they also said the cops had a very hard time obtaining any type of statement from them. Supposedly, Leonore Lemon said that George Reeves had been very depressed because of his career and he wasn't able to find work. And that's what everybody said, because I guess Lemon said at a certain point he's probably going to go shoot himself. All of this is hearsay based on what has been rumored about for several years. But the official story was that Leonore Lemon was totally with these people downstairs when George Reeves killed himself. There's a lot of physical evidence that is questionable. There were no fingerprints on the gun. There was no gunpowder residue on George Reeves' hands. That's also questionable because they didn't test for that in 1959. The bullet was recovered from the bedroom ceiling, yet the shell casing was under his body. There were two additional bullets in the bedroom floor, which Leonore Lemon attributed to a drunken moment with Carol von Ronkel, and she had shot into the floor. but all three bullets were fired from the gun that were at his feet, even though everybody only heard one shot, no forced entry, no physical evidence of a struggle. But it was officially ruled a suicide. Alan Ladd and Gig Young were supposedly the ones who said, very vehemently, along with George Reeves' mother, that it was questionable. The theory that a lot of people have is either that Leonor Lemon, who was very upset by the fact that George Reeves wanted to separate, accidentally shot him while they were drunk, or the other theory is that Toni Mannix, who was the wife of Hollywood fixer Eddie Mannix, was upset that George Reeves had thrown her over for a younger woman, so she told her husband, and her husband sent a couple of goons to go kill him. Those are the theories. The theory that works for me the best, if we want to throw out a theory other than that he killed himself, which I fully believe is possible, I go with the Lemon theory. There was some sort of drunken argument. Leonor Lemon was a wealthy woman of means. She was a socialite, used to getting her way. Wouldn't surprise me if they were drunkenly grappling over a gun. She was trying to threaten him to scare him. The gun goes off. That wouldn't surprise me, especially considering shell casing under the body. If you're gonna blow your brains out, trajectory never really sat right with me. Do I believe, though, that Eddie Mannix had goons come over and kill him? No, I don't buy that. Based on what you've just heard, what are you leaning towards?
I haven't really made a study of the case, but based on just on what I know of just human nature, I think it's entirely possible that it is what it is. I think he probably just ended his own life because he was in a depressing situation. You look at a lot of the details of that and how weird it is, like the shell casing under his body. There are plenty of explanations for that. It could have been on the bed and rolled under him when they like checked the pulse or something. There's a million different ways that a lot of the complicated stuff could be really quite simple. I'm not the kind of person who looks for conspiracies. They can be interesting to talk about, but generally speaking, there needs to be a pretty good reason to suspect more than what we see here. And this isn't the Jack the Ripper murder for me. This seems like pretty straightforward with a couple of weird bits.
When this movie came out, there was a brief moment of resurgence on the case. Most of it led by a Los Angeles publicist named Edward Losey, who claimed that Toni Mannix confessed to a Catholic priest in Losey's presence that she had George Reeves killed. Now, he trotted this out when Unsolved Mysteries did the George Reeves story, so he's been peddling this story since about 1999. Toni Mannix had Alzheimer's disease and ended up dying in 83, and so a lot of people say, really? Really? She was suffering from dementia, but he swears that this confession was a moment of lucidity before she moved to a hospital. That's really been the only claims to anything passing for a confession. Leonor Lemon, I think, died in 86, just lived her life in New York. Nobody ever really came forward and said much of anything. This, for me, is not the Natalie Wood story. You want to talk to me about a conspiracy theory, I'll tell you my Natalie Wood story any day of the week. I don't feel that about this case. I think, if anything, it might have been an accident. It's accidental suicide, you know, we don't know. We probably will never know. Either way, it's very sad. We haven't really talked about portrayals in the movie, at least. The movie does show all three versions of the popular theories. I don't know about you, I think if anything, the movie shows how silly the Eddie Mannix goon theory is.
I don't think the movie buys that one either. And it's one of those things where they keep trying to sell it. Like, one of Eddie Mannix's guys just asked him, was like, is there anything you need to tell me? Is there something we need to have a story for? And then the scene cuts away super ominously.
Eddie Mannix knew where the bodies were buried.
Oh, yeah.
That's well documented. But
which is one of the reasons, which is one of the reasons why I don't buy that he did it. He wouldn't have been so slappy.
The movie tries to allege a couple of things that he has this, like, shadowy history with people. We see him fixing some allegations that an actor is homosexual and something about a farmer's daughter film, and I was like, okay, that makes me think Loretta Young. Is this one of her co-stars? The movie does something that Hail Caesar, I think, does better, which is try to draw comparisons to other stars without naming them outright for legal issues. But I think it's really funny that there's a scene where they're talking about a young actress that he probably killed. And the pictures that they use are from the suicide of Carol Landis, which there's a conspiracy theory for that as well. But I was like, why not just say that then? I don't know what the legalities are of using an actress's name, depending on if there's an estate. But this is one of those movies that I think feels, again, much like the Superman usage, feels very afraid to go with anything based in fact.
Well, it seems afraid to make any real distinctions and real decisions about anything, which is why I think it probably would have been better going with almost a JFK approach, where the ultimate solution is we'll never know, but the fascination is the point. They want to have their cake, and they want to eat it too, but they didn't bring enough cake. They do not have the ammunition to do the damage they want to do. They can't make the dramatic impact because they can't make a decision, and they got neither fish nor fowl with it. And so what we have here is a bunch of everyone is giving their all to this design that isn't very grand. You know, you look at this just as a biopic of George Reeves. Ben Affleck is great. And I think by this point in his career, he understood some of the perils of fame. And I think it's pretty tragic and ironic that he would end up going on to play a DC superhero and running into some troubles with that. It's hard to say how connected they are to his personal strife, but the timing is right on the ball. It adds a lot of gravitas that he's playing that character. And then you have Bob Hoskins, who can snarl with the best of them. You have Diane Lane, who is just phenomenal in everything. But they all have to be in service of this narrative that refuses to take a stand on anything. And as a result, it just doesn't feel like it amounts to much.
It's worth pointing out that by 2006, perceived as the Ben Affleck resurrection, because he had done some subpar movies, with 2004 being Surviving Christmas, the big bomb that was. And this was really his big movie of 06. He did four movies in 2006. Two of them, at least, are cameos. Clerks 2 and Smokin' Aces. But this was considered the big prestige project that was gonna get him back to the A-list. And he's phenomenal in this movie. Playing George Reeves. Maybe not Superman, because we don't really get to see him play Superman. I don't watch this and think, oh god, he needs to replace Henry Cavill. You're not saying that. As George Reeves, though, the two share a physical resemblance, for starters, which I think is good. But he has that classic movie charisma, which is so sad when you watch something like Live by Night, which is also set in the same time period, and it doesn't really work. Ben Affleck is poised for something like an LA Confidential if he wanted it. Bob Hoskins is playing bad Eddie Valiant from Who Framed Roger Rabbit. It's about Diane Lane and Robin Tunney, who play the women in this movie. Because Diane Lane's character, it could have been very easy to make Tony Mannix this sad little Hollywood wife whose husband is in a flagrant relationship with another woman who treats her poorly. He doesn't treat her poorly, actually. I'm going to take that back. There's this scene where they're all having dinner together. So it's George, Tony, Eddie, and Eddie's mistress, who doesn't speak English. And they're all having this discussion, and Tony is asking Eddie about, did he go to the doctor? They have this Hollywood relationship where they trust each other completely. They just don't love each other. The love they have is not physical. It's not romantic, I guess, is the term we're going for here. But I love that we present Tony Mannix as like this sexually awake woman who, when George says, I'm in love with another woman, she's got mouth like a sailor, and she's gonna tell him where to shove it because she's fueled his lifestyle all these years. Yet he never makes an argument about being a kept man. He does argue, though, that she could have helped him, but she wanted to keep him as Superman because it kept him under her thumb. So I like the dichotomy of that relationship, and it's contrasted with Robin Tunney, whose character is just unrepentant, 1940s mall type of character. Brought it up already, when this movie is about real characters and a real series of events, it's really, really slick. It's really fun. It's really engaging. But the movie's not about that.
That we've talked so little about Adrian Brody. His character and his storyline is so nothing. And I give Adrian Brody all the credit in the world for trying to make it work. And Caroline DeVernis, who's a great actor, and she plays his girlfriend in a role that requires her to be his girlfriend.
She's just...
It's really thankless. It's really miserable. And we, like, meet his family and some level that's supposed to give us an in to how kids are responding because his son is upset and burning his Superman costume because Superman not only died, but he killed himself with the Luger, and that means he's a Nazi.
German pistol, yeah.
It's a hell of a thing. If you're gonna create a fictional character through which to look at a real character, which, frankly, if I were teaching a screenwriting class, I would tell you, never do that. It almost never works. It's the protagonist ends up being the least interesting character in the movie. They're just the lens through which the audience can view the character, and we already have that. It's the lens of the camera. We don't need him. If you want to put Adrian Brody in this movie and you want to have him play a detective, he's got to be there for a better reason than this. And he's not. He just learns he needs to spend more time with his family. That wasn't George Reeves' problem.
The Louis Simo character I mentioned plays Bud White in L.A. Confidential. They are very similar characters. Louis is this, I'm only out for myself, I only want to make money, I have this young hot girlfriend, but how dare she sleep around with another guy? Wow, we really needed to get rid of her by just making her a slut. That's wonderful. Thank you for that. There's just nothing there to his character. He's the absentee dad. He's so generic. He checks off every box in White Male Protagonist 101. And if you need a character that's supposed to be the audience substitute, the one that is supposed to help us integrate into this world, help formulate facts that don't exist, then you've done a really poor job of writing, because the movie without him sells the theory is just fine. Maybe you could have had the textbook reporter character or something there to, like, interview people. Going on this big extended plot about how he gets a woman killed because he didn't take her husband's mental illness seriously?
Hold on, you could make an argument about that subplot. And I wish the movie had made this argument, because it could have been there in the text. That ultimately what everyone is trying to do with George Reeves is profit off of someone who was suffering. And suffering from some real mental illness. They're not looking at the actual problem. He doesn't really learn that lesson, though. The movie never really makes that argument. There are all these little pieces I feel like could have been made into something, but amount to nothing, because they just play like a plot point in a generic film noir.
I'm just going to keep throwing in L.A. Confidential. It's like if the characters from L.A. Confidential were busy and they were like, you know what, we'll go down the street to this guy. He'll do it for $3 and it'll be okay. It just feels like a B plot. It's really, really blah. And I think it does take away from the overall impact. There's a great moment at the end with Jeffrey DeMunn, who plays George Reeves's agent. And they're talking about how he was this successful person. It should have been enough for him. And we get the footage of George Reeves trying to prove that he can do this wrestling story. And you can see the anxiousness and the exhaustion on his face. And I was like, all of that's really effective, but it's undercut by constantly going back to Adrian Brody playing this smarmy entitled douche for the entire movie. The movie itself is...
It's about two hours and six minutes. Yeah.
It's 2 hours and 6 minutes. I say that it's about a good hour 40. And then it just slows to a crawl. Once Louis becomes this drunken sod trying to pick his kid up from school while drunk, I think we need to end now.
You dramatically overestimated how much we cared about that movie.
That's where I think the movie really loses it. It's worth pointing out, this was only nominated for one major award. It's nominated for Golden Globe for Ben Affleck in a supporting role in a motion picture. He didn't even get the lead. He got supporting. And he didn't win. I think it's about all this movie deserves. What do you think?
That's about right. Honestly, this probably should have been a made-for-TV movie, and I think Ben Affleck would have gotten an Emmy for it. That would have been the case. If this had been an HBO film, everyone would be like, yeah, this is pretty good for a made-for-TV movie.
Oddly enough, we started with a HBO movie that we think could have been a full-feature film. And we have this movie, which I think could have been a good TV movie. Ironically, in case you were curious what won Best Actor in a Supporting Role in a Motion Picture, it was actually another nostalgia film. Eddie Murphy won for Dreamgirls.
Oh, there you go. Eddie Murphy lost the Oscar to Alan Arkin.
That was a fun year.
That was a hell of a year. A lot of unpredictable stuff. Before we wrap this up, there's one change that they made. It's based on a true story. You have to change some things in order to make it work as a movie. I'm not naive. I know how that works. There's one change that they added, and I honestly cannot figure out why they thought this was important, why they thought they needed to fudge this. There's a scene in Hollywoodland where George Reeves invites his agent over. He says it's bad news, but actually he's celebrating because they canceled Superman, and he's super thrilled. But they never canceled Superman. They didn't cancel Superman until after he died, and they didn't want to do it then. they toyed with other ways around it.
Even when George Reeves wanted to leave, they were finding a replacement so that they could keep it going.
It was a cash machine. It was doing real, real well. I don't understand why they added that scene of Superman getting canceled. It never got canceled, and it doesn't really drive the story anywhere.
I think they want to say that he thought that this was going to lead to fame and fortune. He didn't want to take the role. He was going to be a serious actor. He tried it, and it didn't work, and that's all well and good, but damn the American public for loving it, because it destroyed him in the long run. The only subtext I can come up with.
There's this thing that we think about when we think about celebrities, and it's really dehumanized. This movie would have been a perfect opportunity to really explore that. Instead, I think they only touch on it. We assume that an actor would be incredibly happy to be Superman and to be Superman forever and to not be allowed to do anything else because he was Superman. When in actuality, that can be a very depressing situation. I don't care how much money you make, I don't care how famous you are. People have different wants and desires. And we see this all the time. Filmmakers get pigeonholed in one genre. Just celebrities can't break out of their public perception and they become prisoners of it. Here we see an actor who, whether he killed himself or whether he just died at a time before he was able to pull himself out of it, ultimately paid the ultimate cost for it. It's really humanizing of celebrity, and I appreciate that. I just wish it had gone for it.
A lot of people, especially in 06, when we didn't have this whole mass franchising, stars being lured into 15-movie contract, Marvel aesthetic, interviewed an actress that I was like, how do you feel about being identified with three films you made in the 90s? She's like, at the time, you feel like you have to branch out. You have to prove your range. She's like, nowadays, I would love to be typecast and be in that area of a paycheck and steady income where you can afford to do what you want while still knowing that you're going to get paid. I think a lot of people, especially in 06, before we had all that, thought that the concept of typecasting was classic film related. John Gilbert being denied a film career because of how his voice sounded, even though that wasn't true. Other actors who were stuck playing one thing, Johnny Weissmuller playing Tarzan. We assumed that that was something under the studio system. We don't see it happening now, even though it is happening now, only we're seeing it as financial security. It's the goal of every actor now to get that sweet franchise and never have to work again unless you want to.
It's kind of ironic as well when you look at the George Reeves thing, because a lot of actors the last 10, 20 years have been moving to television, partially for the prestige, but also because it's steady work. When George Reeves was doing television, it was seen as somewhat shameful. He did not want that paycheck. He wanted to do it for the art or for the real money and fame. It wasn't the same back then, whereas now it would be considered the best possible gig.
Bibbs, overall, what do you think about Hollywoodland? Do you recommend it?
I only recommend it to people who are really fascinated with this Hollywood history or people who think Ben Affleck can't act. I would say that right now. Ben Affleck is a good actor. I would not call him a great actor, but when the role fits him, he's really good. And this is one of his best performances. It's not one of his best movies, unfortunately. He's quite good in it. The movie itself is kind of interesting. You probably shouldn't be getting your history from it, but if you're into this kind of true Hollywood story, which you probably are if you're listening to this podcast, it's worth checking out at some point, but it's not going to rock your world and it's not going to become your favorite film.
I'm assuming you're going to say his best work was obviously in Geely.
Oh, well, yes. That or Forces of Nature. I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We could do a whole episode called Ragging on Ben Affleck.
I happen to think Ben Affleck is actually really talented, but he's just also been in a lot of crap. And you can say that for most people in Hollywood.
You can say that for a lot. And as somebody who is a reformed Ben Affleck stan, okay, who has seen probably more movies than I should from his filmography. When he's good, he's great. When he's bad, the movie is just terrible. Overall, I would recommend this. You're gonna see the threads, the seams connected to other movies, other better movies. This, I say, wants to be L.A. Confidential, and it's not. L.A. Confidential is a great gateway movie if you are interested in classic Hollywood, the scandal nature of that time period. This is a great follow-up to that. If you like L.A. Confidential, I'd say watch this. You do need to have some sort of awareness of why George Reeves was important, because if you look at the title Hollywoodland, you're going to think it's a generic story about L.A., and it's not. You do need to have some knowledge of who George Reeves was. That being said, I'd go with Bibbs's idea that it would have been a great TV movie to really dig into George Reeves' persona and the creation of a working actor turned icon, all of that. Maybe one day the fates will be kind, but in the end, this is a decent movie. Just fast forward over the Adrian Brody parts. You're really not going to lose anything. If you like Hollywoodland or you don't like Hollywoodland, you can email me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com and we'll read your comments on an upcoming episode. Before we close things out, Bibbs, what's going on with your other projects? Where can people listen to them, get in touch with you, all of that?
Okay, well, I got a lot of stuff, so everyone sit back for a second.
Strap in.
Okay, so I currently co-host the critically acclaimed podcast over on the Schmoes Know Network. We review new movies, and we do a double feature every week of an allegedly bad movie and a classic movie that pairs well with it and brings out something interesting about it. I also co-host the Cancel Too Soon podcast, in which we review television series that lasted only one season or less. September is our suddenly last season month, in which we only review shows that were canceled in the last season of television. So you'll see a bunch of recent ones, but we often do a lot of esoteric stuff as well. If you join me on the patreon.com/canceledtoosoon page, and we always spell canceled with one L, it's a real spelling. We also have bonus podcasts, one of which might be of particular interest to your fans. It's called Only the Best, and we review every nominee for Best Picture in order. And I think we're coming up on the 4th Annual Academy Awards real, real soon. In addition to that, I write for The Wrap. I write for IGN. We have a website called criticallyacclaimed.net, which we have some original content, but we also link to all of our work elsewhere on the internet in case you're looking for a hub for me or my co-host Whitney Seibold. I'm on Twitter at William DeBiani, and if you love movie trivia, you should check me out on the Movie Trivia Schmodown, which is a YouTube series which combines movie trivia with the theatrics of wrestling, and I am currently the singles champion in that league. So I think that's it.
You're a jack of all trades. How you have time to record with me is... I'm not convinced that you're just sleeping with your eyes open.
Sleep? What? Who is he?
In case others are interested in finding out what I'm doing, if you are listening to Ticklish Biz regularly, hopefully by the time this episode comes out, I should be all caught up on updating episodes. So my episode on How to Marry a Millionaire should be up, where I interviewed Sarah Louise Lilly. I should also have the next couple of episodes up with our regular Ticklish Biz co-host, Drea Clark. I know her and I are going to be honoring Teresa Wright the month of September.
That is awesome. A lot more credit. That's amazing, and I have to make sure to listen to those episodes.
Yes. And then Samantha Ellis and I are doing a birthday show, because both our birthdays are in September, so we are going to be talking about the Esther Williams film On an Island with You. If you've never seen it, it's the delightful story about a man who feels that a woman who kissed him one time is destined to be his girlfriend, so he kidnaps her and takes her to a remote island in order to make her love him. It's a little problematic. You can also check out my other podcast where I do Citizen Dame, where we talk about feminism and what's currently going on in film. Spoiler alert, it's usually bad, because there's a lot of bad stuff that happens in entertainment, especially lately, which you can listen to at citizendame.podbean.com. You can also check out my other work on Twitter at journeys_film. I do all sorts of other things. Speaking of sleep, yeah, we have a very contentious relationship. So Bibbs and I are just living on a lot of caffeine and God's good humor. But we will be back. I know I said I was going to do every other month, but based on how these episodes have been edited, I'm just going to say we're going to be out soon, because I think we're just going to end up doing both shows once a month based on my editing schedule. It might work out that way, but this will be up sooner rather than later. If you are also listening on Patreon, please be sure to listen to my other supplemental show I make for you guys called Doubled Features with Adam Kautzer. We're going to be talking about the remake of The Bad Seed. That's going to air on Lifetime. Actually, by the time this goes out, but it will already have been on Lifetime. Directed by Rob Lowe.
What?
You didn't know? Nobody seemed to know that.
What?
If you haven't seen that, you haven't seen the 1956 version, the original, there's also a 1980s version with David Carradine and a bunch of other people. Should be very interesting. So that'll be up soon as well. If you have suggestions, movies you want us to talk about, true crimes that you find interesting, email them to us, because this podcast lives and dies on your suggestions. We'll be back next episode talking about another true Hollywood stories. I'm Kristen Lopez here with William Bibbiani, and we'll see you next time.
Palo on the drum.